Welcome to Beyond Music with Sylvia Nakash and John Bierman. Today we'll be joined by Rick Jarrow. As a pioneer of the anti-career movement and author of Creating the Work You Love, Rick Jarrow has helped thousands open to their intuition, transform their values into action, and answer their true calling, instead of settling for yet another job. In this episode, we share a spontaneous conversation on the experience Rasa, a missing link in the Western aesthetics.
Rasa, it's different from normal emotion. It's emotion magnified 1,000 times and taken to its source.
We will also cover poetic insights on raga music, tantra, kirtan, and Rick's latest book, The Cloud of Longing. Rick kicks off the discussion with an example of being transported and how that can be misunderstood in Western culture.
I've been asked many winters ago at a meeting of the American Academy of Religion. I chanted a similar verse from the Ramayana, the great first poem of the Sanskrit tradition, about Hanuman jumping over the ocean and carrying this mountain, which had the healing herb to save his Lord Rama. And during that story, Hanuman is often compared to a cloud. And it also says Hanuman Manasa Jagama, that Hanuman went through by his mind. It's like a shaman. He traveled through his mind. So when I was reciting this magical flight, I got very inspired. And the respondent was kind of annoyed because I was, quote, I don't remember exactly what he said, but it seemed like Jarrow was transported, you know, reading that, like, this is a problem. And my response was, if you're not transported, why are you bothering with it? So that's kind of how I relate to this stuff. It's pure feeling, transportation, and some sort of the revelation beyond language, but through language.
Why do you think he thought it was a problem?
Because the Western tradition of critical apprehension of texts has lost its feeling function. And very often in the West, we've moved so over into the energy of thinking without being tempered by the heart that there's literally an embarrassment. If people, like, I used to have a student who would raise his hand and say, I feel, and the class would look at him like something was wrong. We don't have much of a tradition of aesthesis, you know, emotional transportation. And that's why I think he was a little disconcerted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's probably one of the challenges of our Western society a little bit, is kind of getting over that.
Yes.
And you were talking about that, I was thinking that, yes, we have this, all these levels of connections and engagement with music, and it come from including, adding to the experience of music consciousness, or what we call the nature of the way that the mind works. And the Buddhism will be like Sambhogakaya, Dharmakaya.
Yes. And that's so funny you said that.
Yes, because when you were talking, I was transported to my practitioner of the mindset, you know, because it's all about setting, another part that you bring into anything we want to offer requires this, the ceremonial setting. For the Dagara tradition of Africa, is a generous welcome, generous welcoming. So in psychotherapy, remember when I was a psychotherapist, the setting was the most important aspect, the timing, the space. We are setting. We are. Sound needs an envelope to be produced, to be heard. There's no sound without hearing. So all these things were just, whenever Rick talks, I have like a multi-dimensional possibilities of inspiration, so many places to go. But today I was going to the Dharmakaya, Sambhogakaya, Nirmayakaya, and feeling that that's the piece that I bring into my music teachings. You know, how the music feels in those three dimensions, because music is symbolic but can be heard, and becomes the feeling is when we hear the music, when we listen to the music. And then it comes this idea of Dharmakaya, how the music can transport us to different places. And what is transport is our energy, our mind. So anyway, I think that there are so many aspects of how understanding the magic fly of Hanuman can be a teaching of music in healing. Would you elaborate on that, Dr. Rick Jarrow?
Just to get back to what John asked, there's a beautiful little poem by Billy Collins called Introduction to Poetry. And it goes like this. It says, I ask them to take a poem and hold it up to the light like a color slide, or press an ear against its hive. I say, drop a mouse into a poem and watch him probe his way out. Or walk inside the poem's room and feel the walls for a light switch. I want them to water ski across the surface of a poem, waving at the author's name on the shore. But all they want to do to the poem is tie it to a chair with rope and torture a confession out of it. They begin beating it with a hose to find out what it really means. You know,
I like that.
It's so synchronistic, Sylvia. This morning, I was just meditating on this, that I think after I read your article, I started thinking about the relationship between the aesthetic and the Trikaya. And I said that the aesthetic dimension is the Sambhogakaya. It's the body of bliss. And that's what's missing. It's what's missing in the critical tradition. It's what's, you know, without that, you know, where's the rus? You know, where's the juice? And this word rasa literally is the juice of a poem or a work of art or a piece of music, which you have to drink it. It becomes part of you and it transports you. It's love potion number 9, you know? So, yeah, I feel
and I think why we can benefit the field of sound in healing and music in healing, how we can contribute to the unfolding, the investigation, the divineness of it, grow divine, just the field, is by giving a little bit more truth to it, the satya. Because I think the rasa, in a way, is connected to beauty and the expression. And at the same time, if we feel the goosebumps, it's absolutely truthful.
Yeah.
So the truth is the truth of, say, doing something musically or sonically, because it's transporting us to a space of bliss. What you say, the space of Anand, the space of long breath. I did it.
You know,
it's so beautiful when we say, I did it, you know, and that comes from truth. It's not just, you know, playing this beautiful, that's why those beautiful, incredible, amazing performers, pretty much Yo-Yo Ma, you know, becomes like a deity going everywhere. He's doing master classes, he's doing publicities, he's doing everything, you know, he's bringing his message. And this is something I like to bring into the field. You say the message of the cloud. Can you take us a little bit to the journey of the cloud?
It's very interesting. In the cloud of longing, this exiled, pining yaksha asks a cloud to deliver a message to his beloved. And the entire poem is the yaksha telling the cloud the journey that he's going to take and where he's going to go and who he's going to meet. But it's also very clear, and this is what's so confoundingly beautiful, that the cloud never goes anywhere. This is all imagined. It doesn't really happen. And this is like what rasa, in many ways, you could see it in like someone like Wordsworth, as poetry is recollection in tranquility. But the idea is that the feeling, the experience, the connecting to that depth is beyond the circumstance. Does that make some sense?
Absolutely.
This is a terrible example, but it works. If a little kid gets run over by a bus, you know, that's a tragedy, and we all, you know, we feel it. But if you read a book or see a movie in which a kid is run over by a bus, you know it's not really happening, but it still hits you in that place. And so the beauty of rasa is that it's taking you beyond the concrete. It's taking you into the soul of things. And therefore, it doesn't just have to be rainbows and puppy dogs' tails to be beautiful. One rasa is bayanaka, which means disgust. You know, one rasa is raudra, which is anger. You know, these, they all work. It's kind of like when my son was two, I walked in at two or two and a half, and he was watching Batman. And I was, you know, I was a new parent, so a little concerned. I said, oh, Sean, isn't this little violent or something? And he just looks at me, he said, he used to call me Rick, even when he was two. He said, no, Rick, it's just make-believe. But here's the thing, we discount make-believe. Oh, it's not a fact. But in an aesthetic tradition, it might be higher than the fact. It's the origin of the fact. So you fall in love and you're in heaven for a few weeks or months or years, and then it invariably falls apart. And you ask, what happened? Well, you can get very negative about people, or you can say that love has an origin. And that origin is the eternal love, is the rasa of Sringar. And it can express through human beings. But if you can sing the rasa, if you can allow yourself to be permeated by that rasa, it's said to be Brahma's father. It gives you the taste of the absolute.
That's it's a secret longing of every artist. Mm. It's actually, there's no separation between art and rasa. So the moment that we make a soup, if we are concentrated, that's one of the aspects that we call it transportation. Our mind is in dharana, is right, single pointed. We are present. We are listening. We are not trying to sell something. Sorry. You know, it's like, it's interesting. Well, maybe you try to sell something. I don't know. But the point here is that there's so much concentration, heightening of awareness, that is almost like the consciousness becomes a way of breathing. You become a poet, you become a seeker, you are chasing, the metaphor is chasing you, and you are chasing the metaphor, and you are suspended in a reality that is very safe because it's children's mind. Mm-hmm. Children's are pure rasa. I just want to be with children all the time, because children are, for children, rasa is the first experience of life.
To me, it seems like it's all feeling and senses and tastes and feeling. I don't know. That's what I'm getting out of this. That's what I'm trying to make sense in my head. What rasa is, not a rasa, but rasa.
The Sanskrit aestheticians, the way they saw it was that it's a process of ever deepening tasting. And what allows you to taste as a rasika or connoisseur of the rasa is your awareness of all the nuances going on and the place where it resonates in the depth of the heart. So I've always found it very interesting, just to totally switch this lens. I've always found it very interesting that the early Bob Dylan, a number of his songs had biblical references, which a lot of people, they don't know it consciously, but it's resonating on the rasa of the Western mind. God said to Abraham, kill me a son. Abe said, man, you must be putting me on. You know, this is the sacrifice of Isaac, which is this, you know, at the basis of Western tradition. So it's resonating on levels that are deeper than your everyday feeling. Mm-hmm. So when I, you know, what am I falling in love with? What is the music? You know, what's it transporting in me? It's transporting me to my actual self, to the level of who I am in terms of Satchit Ananda. If Brahman or truth is defined or spoken of in Indian tradition as Satchit Ananda, which is something like being, knowledge, and bliss, the aesthetic and the music would be the bliss aspect. And we just don't have a lot of that. In the Ayurvedic medical tradition, they speak of rasa. The first level in which food enters the body is rasa, is the taste. And the taste is not insignificant. The taste of a particular food sets off a reaction in the body and body chemistry and so on and so forth. And if we take that away, then we get the contemporary one-size-fits-all medical model, where whatever Rasa you have, whatever constitution you have, doesn't matter, because we fix everybody the same. So the thing about Rasa also is that your particular feeling constitution is your Rasa. Some people are in flow Rasa. Some people are in, I don't know, what are
the ugly one.
The other, yeah. But it's okay if, you can work with it. I mean, I never understood it's so late in the game, how the Indian tradition talked about that the incarnation of God sometimes comes into the world to fight for the fun of it. Like, he can't fight in heaven, so he fights on earth. I never understood that until I had kids. And then when my son was three, he used to come up to me and say, "Come on, Dad, let's fight." And it was the rasa of, and it was pure joy. So if you're not attached to the result, which would be karma, then anything is a lila. Even it might be gross, but I'll use it anyways. There's a line in one of the Rambo movies where Sylvester Stallone says, "In order to fight in a war, you have to become war." You have to be in the rasa of combat. And interestingly, people who fight each other, as in football, they respect each other. They respect their fortitude. They respect their courage because we know it's a game, but it's a game that allows us to express this energy. It's all good.
Is rasa bigger than the giver or the receiver, or is it?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's you tune into it.
Yeah.
But it's already there.
In music is, John and Rick, in music is the difference between a scale and a raga.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The scales are linear, are, sometimes necessary, but the raga is before and beyond the scale, because the raga is the symbolic aspect of the scale. It's a seed that comes from a scale and leaves the tree, and start giving this particular, convey this particular rasas. Raga rasa is a system. There's no raga without rasa. There's no rasa without raga in music, in Indian classical music. Now, they have different, predominance in terms of, the different styles of Indian classical music give more or less importance to ras. But the point here is that in Indian classical music, there is no music without rasa.
Does that carry over to Western classical music?
I think so. Is that lasting quality of something in music that you listen forever and ever, like what you are telling about Dylan or the Beatles. I mean, the Beatles got this shringar, at a point, and that, there is also like mantras, in their own way. Some people said that there were some hidden mantras in some of their music. And they were very inspired. They were very bhakti in their own way. So maybe Rick can talk a little bit about that. In my experience as a Western classical musician and going to three conservatories and then coming here in exile because it was very dangerous to live in South America, and I come here and I meet Ali Akbar Khan, and I smell the perfume of the music. Hmm. And I say, basta, c'est tout. I don't need anything else. It was all that I was doing. I started all over again. I was not the kind of star music psychotherapy that brought music into the Lacan therapy. No. Lacan for me, when I was a clinical psychologist, Lacan and Freud was rasa for me. I can't explain this. It was just so interesting the way that everything was in function of energy for Freud, and anything was in function of poetry for Lacan. So I had the rasa constitution because we all have, it's innate, is baby, is Buddha mind, is baby food, is the taste of the milk.
Rasa, theoretically, it's different from normal emotion. It's emotion like magnified 1,000 times and taken to its source. That's the big point. So it takes you, instead of like ear candy or eye candy, you can go into it again and again and again because it's taking you to the source. There's a beautiful line in the Upanishad that says, Rasovai Saha, which Saha in this case meaning God. And it says God is Rasa, or he is Rasa. That it's not just my emotion, but it's coming from the universe itself, which is why the ragas is so interesting because they're, you know, as Sylvia said, they're connected to colors and perfumes and also to seasons and times of day. So it's kind of a cosmic experience.
How would you know the difference between rasa and an emotion? How can you describe it? It might be difficult to describe in words.
An emotion is something that is based on a set of circumstances that impacts you. The rasa is already there, and a work of art or circumstances awakens that within you. Once that is awakened, you can always access it through music and through poetry. So it's not limited. You can hold that emotion, or it holds you, and it holds you to such a degree that it overwhelms the separate self. That's the difference, that rasa overwhelms the ego. And there's so many people trying to get rid of the ego, which is impossible because who's doing it? Whereas with the rasa, it's like the ocean just takes you and you're part of the Ananda Buddhi Bardhanam, the ever increasing knowledge and bliss of the ocean of existence. So rasa connects you to the ocean of existence. And if you have that connection, you'll see it in your child, you'll see it in your lover, but you'll see it a different way. You'll see them as, it's little John, but it's also little Krishna at the same time.
I have been crying a lot lately. And I'm not a crying person. I'm very, very sensitive and very, very crack open. And the rasa is right on the at the tip of my lips, you know. And it's of course because I chant all the time. It's not really connected with that. And I don't know exactly what it is, but I think it's because what you were talking before, Rick, because I miss my guru. Because I haven't seen him for 2-3 months. I have a new Guruji, and I haven't seen him since August. You know, I was having sessions with him so often and all the time, and then I haven't seen my guru for 2 months, and I feel like a baby. I feel abandoned. It's very interesting, and I think it's because of that, because I was a psychotherapist for so long, and a very good one. I think it's abandonment. What makes me so transparent?
That's interesting because there's a name for that rasa. It was in the first verse of the Megadutta, Kaschit Kanta Viraha Guruna. Viraha means separation. It's the missing. And a lot of the rasikas say that experience, that feeling of separation, takes you to the deepest level of being overwhelmed by love, even more than union. So this great rasika named Sanatan Goswami walked into the hut of his master Chaitanya and found a leaf on this palm leaf on the thatched roof that had a verse on it. And the verse was about when Krishna met the gopis after years and years of being separated from them. And he said to them, come live with me and be my queens forever. And they said, no. because we want to remember you as the cowherd boy in Brindavan when we grew up. Like we cultivate the separation because it's the deepest connection imaginable. And so that's the, you know, we would call it in Greek aesthetics, they might see that as the power of tragedy. But for India, it's not tragedy because the separation is a lila. It's a play in the universe, which is always one. So they say achinta bheda bheda tattva. It's inconceivably and simultaneously one and different. And so the Sambhogakaya is like, is the play of existence, the beauty, the bliss within the Dharmakaya of absoluteness. So the rasa, it sees itself as taking you to the core of your heart, of the heart, not your heart, but the heart. I don't know if that's helpful or not, but that's kind of how they see it. And it's much more than emotion. The closest thing to it in the West might be Plato, because, you know, Plato spoke about the world of forms beyond the world of objects. So in an ordinary emotion, it's an object, you know, since my baby left me, I'm in Viraha. But if you take that to the end of time, and it's always, and you're always in that mood, and that mood overwhelms everything else, and you're in this space of ecstasy and loss and love, then it moves up into Rus or Rasa. Yeah, it's maybe another, the other person who's coming. It's funny, we're talking sports here, but there was a great West Coast ball player named Willie Mays. I think everyone loved about Willie Mays was, yeah, he was a great ball player, but more than anyone else, he loved to play baseball. Like you could see it. He had the joy. He was like this living joy. I love to catch ball. I love to run. And that's the Russell.
I can comment on Steph Curry from the Warriors.
Yeah.
He's that. I can feel it every time he plays. But I've been for the last 5-10 years, and it's getting more and more. He's getting better. He has so much joy and love for what he does. As you can just see it coming out of him on the court. It's incredible. Yeah, never seen a player like him.
Yeah, that's the Russ.
He absolutely has it.
I think it's a quality, innate quality that makes us feel more alive, aliveness. There's something of aliveness. And then I will bring this into the rasa that we sometimes, that sometimes is not is fear, is disgust, is aggression, you know. Can we compound rasas in a way that people can be more kind to each other? I mean, Dalai Lama, His Holiness, is trying to do that daily through his teachings, but not reaching everybody.
You know, I don't know. I don't have an answer to that, but I go back to Steph Curry. Michael Jordan was in the Vira Rasa. He wasn't in the Joy Rasa. He was a Vira Bhav, we'd say in India. It was heroism. I'm going to beat you.
Agreed.
And I would say, I once asked, actually, I believe I once invited Phil Jackson to come to my class at Vassar. So he gave a class called Sports and Religion. And he came.
Wow.
Because I said, here's a chance to speak with no reporters, you know, and the students were really tough. I said, what good is the NBA? You know, what have you done for anybody, you know, besides making certain money for certain people? And he said, when we won the championship, it united the city in such a beautiful way. Like that is what he was seeing as its value. I would see it differently. Is there anything we could do? I would argue that we need spaces for where people can express themselves honestly and emotionally that are safe and that take you somewhere instead of taking you nowhere.
Good food,
good music together. Like a perfect example in capitalist culture, which we all live in, we're all fish swimming in the water, but there's such a competition for people who want to be actors. You know, it's like this cutthroat competition. And what's stopping you if you had a bunch of people who are together and you created a stage and a community and you had like monthly plays for the community, you know, you'd be able to act. You have a vessel for it. And that's the setting. The vessel is the setting. The music has a certain protocol. The poetry has a certain protocol which allows you to be safe and to express these really powerful energies in a way that's helpful but not hurtful.
So yesterday, every Thursday for the past 30 years, I've been chanting with my students. And I, believe it or not, I have some of the same students for 30 years. And it's, we don't even think, if I'm home, we sing. At 5 o'clock, we sing on Thursday. Because of whatever captivity we had for 19 months, now it's super multicultural, multi-global, whatever we'd say that. It's almost cosmic. We meet every day. And yesterday, my intention was to say, oh, we are over at the end of the year. Let's do some mantra because ragas are a little bit, require so much concentration. Some people don't have the musical background. So I say, I'm going to do mantra. And I was just directed to do mantra because mantra are more like repetition. The configuration of melody is very small. It's like a medicine melody. It's like taking a medicine that is very gentle, or it's more like a, I think that mantras are adaptogens. Mm. So in medicine. So I think let's do mantra and let's cool down a little bit because the ragas are, wow, they require so much sensibility, appreciation, intellect. And detail and ras. And then what happened is that I ended up not doing mantra. I ended up doing what I do every time when I start my sessions, tuning with the syllables that are connected with the actually physical abstract aspects of sound, pure sound, Nara yoga. We start the syllables for tuning the mind with the body and everything that is connected to the presence, the being present, asana. And then I ended up doing the raga that just completely came into my spine. I mean, I couldn't control it. The raga was raga Yeman Kalyan. And the light was coming down. And the raga just came. I have a goosebumps when I'm talking right now. The raga just says, sorry, I'm here. It has to be, you know. The raga came, and then I did the mantra at the end.
Do you remember it?
At the very end,
I did the raga that you did?
Yes.
Can you do a little bit of it?
No.
Can you talk a little bit about how music plays a role, sound plays a role in Tantra, and what actually is Tantra? I know it has a sort of a lot of people in the West think of sex with tantric, but it's more than that, obviously. And just maybe you could talk a little bit about it.
Well, Tantra comes from the verbal root tan, which means to weave. And so it's a tradition that says you can come to non-dual consciousness, enlightenment, whatever you want to call it, not only through deprivation, but through, I don't want to say indulgence, but I just said it. And the sound relationship is really interesting because in the tantric texts like Satchakra and Nirupana, each of the chakras is said to contain certain letters of the Sanskrit alphabet. So each chakra resonates with certain sounds. Certain traditions would say you can only come to absolute reality through silence. Tantra would say truth in silence or voice in silence or sound in silence are two sides of the same coin. And you can work with any external discipline if you see it as, you know, connecting to its origin. It becomes a means, an upaya, or a means to illumination. So a simple one might be eating. From a mundane perspective, I'm eating this. From a tantric perspective, the Divine Mother is eating through me. It's all happening through me. And a tantric theoretically would drink but not get drunk, would play music but not get into the, I don't know what you guys call it. It's kind of like the low level ear candy.
Saturated.
Okay. As opposed to being able to remain conscious during the music and to really hear the sound to the point where you are the sound. Also, Tantra is very interesting in that it's looking more and more like historically, the earliest layer of adepts were women. Before they got kind of taken over by the male monasteries and connected to the mother goddess. But on the deep level, it's the practice of non-duality in the world. So anything you do can be tantric. In karmic consciousness, you're doing something to get a result for yourself. All right. In bhakti, you do an offering to an absolute that's somewhere over there in your heart. In Tantra, you have Ramakrishna taking the offering to Goddess Kali and dumping it on his own head. At that point, he's either gone crazy or he's realized his oneness with the goddess. And it's all the same with them, whether I'm playing this note or that note. That's why it's very much like Carioca, who's a Brazilian singing shaman. At a certain point in his evolution, he, in addition to singing the liturgical Portuguese songs, he began just singing Brazilian folk songs. And his point was the same thing that John Cage made, you know, a century before, that everything is music. You know, music is everything. And Tantra sees it that way.
There's also, in my experience of Tantra in music, is the experience of continuation. There's an element of threat. You are in a virtual reality in a way, and you stay there, and it unfolds, evolves, and becomes. So I always understood the concept of Tantra, not the experience of Tantra, as a transformation that evolves. Mm. We are talking about Carioca, which I love, and we have something very in common with Carioca. We have the same lineage, actually, in both sides, from the medicine and from the music, which was so close to me.
And Tantra says very simply, you can also find spirit in the world. And therefore, anything you do, cooking, playing music, whatever it is, it can be an upaya, an instrument in the realization of absolute consciousness. So since monasticism does not do well in the United States, we might be made for Tantra.
And then there's something about that I like to say that in terms of the experience of Tantra as transformation and, you know, continuous evolving practice, you know, like sometimes we do a practice, but how to evolve the practice. And then you say something incredible, Rick Jarrow, when we were, you know, teaching at CIIS together and separating, but within that extraordinary program that started so many other things, until got confused. I mean, now sound healing is sound bath, and it's not possible. So sound in healing, it's big, it's silence. So I like to say something that you said that was, creativity is not an individual process. You said that, and everything changed. because of you said that, one of my students wants to hear more of you in Esalen. And the next day she had a baby. She found a lover in Esalen and had a baby. The other student, which is a very, very, very wealthy person, just cannot live without your teachings. And actually, I don't know if you know John, but Rick also reads Vedic charts for people in his own way. I mean, it's his own interpretation as well. But what I wanted to bring is when you say creativity is not an individual process, became a mantra. A mantra for the work, because then you realize that it's about the collaboration with earth, with life, with people, with children, with shamans, with medicine. It's about co-creation. And co-creation is within the spirit of music. We make music with instruments that can be the voice, can be the breath, can be, but that sense of co-creation is what we discover when we are children, and then for some reason become something like, oh, I'm not a singer, or oh, I'm not this. You know, we always can co-create with something.
Even if you're creating something on your own, completely on your own, and in a room by yourself, you're kind of still not by yourself.
Rick, what about your expansion into kirtana?
Well, it's funny because I kind of grew up with kirtana. I started when I was in my teens. Then I stopped for many years. I just stopped playing music. I got into the teaching archetype, I guess. And then I met karaoke. And karaoke has a certain siddhi, a certain power that whoever hangs out with them, like, they get infected by music. And it's like through meeting karaoke, the harmonium just came back to me. And I play medicine songs and Indian kirtan songs, and I play with other people. But the amazing thing for me with the harmonium is, one, I don't know how to play, but I play. So my Indian colleagues call it Guru Kripa. It's the mercy of Guru. The other thing about it not being a collective, not an individual endeavor, is you're usually doing at least call and response with kirtan. And unfortunately, from my point of view anyway, well, it's fortunate because people have found out about it. But a lot of the West, they think of kirtan as going to a show and someone's going to play for me, or I'm going to play a show for somebody. And that's not what it is. It's literally a practice. It's a practice of glorifying God through sound. And it happens most effectively when, as Bharata says in the Natya Shastra, when rasa is achieved, the separation between the audience, the actors, and then whoever else is involved in the play just dissolves, and it becomes one flow of musical rus. And that's what I love about the harmonium. And the other, I don't know, just, well, I'm saying it for whatever, it's better or worse. When I play the harmonium, especially in ceremony, I often experience myself in a different body. I'll say that much. So it brings in, you know, whoever, whatever wants to come in. But again, I can really feel the difference. Like if I'm just playing to sound nice or relieve boredom, it doesn't achieve rasa. The rasa only happens when it's a conscious appreciation, glorification, and when you give everything, like you have to leave it all out on the field, there's nothing left, then it happens. And I, you know, it was given, the harmonium was given to me as a gift, and I still see it that way.
Beautiful. And then, you know, recitation, your voice is rasa. So what I you know, I in India, they call me a voice culturist. They define, you know, when they present things in India, they read my bio and they say Sylvia is a voice culturist.
Culturist, I like that.
Yeah, a culturist in the sense of cultivating and releasing, you know, the voice as a sound itself, not necessarily connected
like a voice farmer
with the singer. Yeah, that's the voice farmer. The singer is another archetype that has a lot of limitation as an envelope, as a setting, because it requires, it immediately takes the mind into the rasa of I don't know, which is a rasa too, is an emotion. You know, it's a sense of, it's a way of you know, putting yourself down when you just have to do it again.
You know, in traditional India, nobody would ever read a poem by themselves. The silent reading is not, you have to recite it out loud, then it's poetry.
And you know, John Cage that you mentioned, for him, the most natural way of expressing this music as sound and getting the Zen aspect of I'm not there, who I am, he was mostly talking. I mean, his the sound that he brought was telling stories. He was a kind of Zen Krishna.
Interesting.
What I like the most, and I collected, of course, because I'm a collector, I mean, of art, and I was the collector of his talkings. There are teachings where he talks about mushrooms, and he talks about what happened when he smokes, and he talks, and the talk, he went from writing music to talking, and then his music might be played at the same time on a symphonic kind of configuration. But there are so many ways that we can express, which means to put pressure out, right? We can express, what is the longing? The journey of the cloud.
Out of longing, yeah.
Yeah, I like the idea of express, putting pressure out. And now what I think that we need to consider for this particular here and now setting is, what are the rasas? Because my divine first guru for 29 years, Ali Akbar Khan, he had a 10 rasa, which actually became the most important rasa in raga. So I would like you to talk about raga, the rasas, the 9 or the 8 rasas, and then I will reveal the 10 rasa.
Well, traditionally, it depends what tradition, it can be 8 or 9. There's Sringar, which is love. We might say romantic love, but it's said to be the ultimate rasa. Hasya rasa, which is like that. Adbut, which is wonder, rasa of wonder.
My favorite.
That's a good one. How about vira or courage or heroism? This is fun. Shanta or peace.
Shanti, shanti.
Karuna, compassion.
Everything. We have to. Ever Karuna is kind of is the driving, is the Mercedes van of the rasas.
All right, now we have three more. Let's say you do these: Raudra or anger, fury.
Mm-hmm.
Bayanaka, or fear.
Think about Hitchcock movie. The scene of the shower.
Oh my God.
The termite.
All right, and finally, bibatsa, or disgust.
Ah, that is very visual for me lately. It's incredible visually. Here in Berkeley, everywhere under the bridge is all that. Can you say more about that, Rasa? Because it's really here and now in the world.
Well, it's definitely characterized by a certain type of judgment. You know, I feel that there's like fear and loathing, like I can't stand this. The interesting thing about it, Mary Douglas's famous book, Purity and Danger, like what's pure in one culture is impure in another. So some people actually like to put banana and peanut butter on sandwiches. And some people think that's the most disgusting thing in the world. So it depends on your position, what is disgust and what is not. But something like that. And there is something which is really interesting in relationships also, probably in music. It's called rasa basa. It's when there are two rasas that don't mix. You know, like this musician and that musician, they just don't mix together. And
Aliyapra Kham would call it confusion.
Okay. All right.
Yes.
So those are your nine. What's the 10?
The 10 is tyag.
Ah, okay.
Detachment.
Okay.
Tyag, detachment. Detachment and a kind of loving separation. When you go in during the evolution, the development of the raga, there's a moment that you shift the rasa. And the raga is a journey. So you change from one rasa to another rasa, no more than two or three rasas in one raga. Mm. And then suddenly at the end, you detach. Mm-hmm. In every music, at the end, even in those moments of silence between the alap and the jara and the jala and all that, in those moments of before the drummers comes in the music, there's after the alap, when the alap is the journey to the North Star, right? It's a big journey between the clouds. And then at the end of the alap, there is a detachment. And then comes the musicians kind of coughing or take some water, get some, you know, the alap normally is 40 minutes, 45 minutes. And then the other musician that has been there sitting the whole time, the drummer, with an incredible sahaj and shrad, you know, reverence and everything, start tuning their instruments. So they do the second part. So there is always this sense of tyag. Even if the music is beautiful, at some point, you have to let it melt. Like a cloud. And this is what happened in New Age music, what they call New Age music. They get the shanti and they do a shanti for 45 minutes. And that gets depression, you know, depressive, because there's no sense of detachment and the dynamics of emotion. It's all about duration for me. Since I'm more and more involved now and decided that I started all over again with you know, it's always like a reincarnation with music. You are always a beginner, and that's the beauty. You're always young in music. You never get old with music. That's another piece. When you're creative and you enter in the ras, and you are longing for ras, then you don't have time to get old. It's all about the affirmative connection with life, with truth.
How can somebody out there get into the ras listening to this?
Listening. And I always tell the people I have around my life, which mostly now is in a box, in a computer, you know, if you like something, follow. follow. If you like a musician, if you like this music, don't stay with that tune only. You know, go inside that music and find more music of the same composer. I mean, if I listen to Mahler, I start, my whole life will be, if I listen to Mahler, the rasa comes back to me, for example. If I listen to the first tuning of Ali Akbar Khan Sarod, I am in rasa. Because rasa is intimacy too. It has a quality of intimacy, of familiarity, of being home. We are back. Can you talk a little bit about the new book, please?
Well, it's called The Cloud of Longing, and it's a translation and study of the Meghaduta of Kalidasa. Meghaduta means cloud messenger. So why I got involved with it, aside from my teachers pushing me, is that it gives you a sense, it offers a different sense of what nature is. In the Natya Shastra, rasa is defined, vibhava anubhava, vyabhachari samyogad rasa nishpatihi, that rasa is achieved by the combination of the vibhavas, the stimulants, like the autumn moon, for example, anubhava, the subtle stimulants, like the fragrance wafting through the grass, vyabhachari, these accessory emotions, samyoga, you put them all together and you get rasa. So the example that they give is cooking, that you blend the ingredients skillfully and you get this taste. If you really wanted to live a more rasa-oriented life, at the end of the day, instead of asking, what was this day like or what's going to happen tomorrow, you could say, well, what did this day taste like? And that will put you, you know, in the consciousness of ras, that we're not here to know, but the knowledge comes through tasting of the heart.
What is the taste of music?
It depends on the music. It
depends on the music. And depends on the person too.
Yeah, in the Meghaduta of Kalidasa, there's all kinds of music. The Shiva plays the drum, and the drum is the thunder of the cloud. Okay. The geese are singing a certain song as they walk upon the way. The siddhas in the sky have their flutes and they're playing. Wherever he goes, wherever this cloud goes in the natural world, there's music. The kinaras, who are the celestial beings who sing, you know, are up there. So you're in a world of a swirl of sound cloud, okay, wherever you go. And the rus, there's a beautiful line that John Cage said about Thoreau, which I think is a real good Russell line. He said, many men have vision. Thoreau had none. He just walked the world with his eyes and ears open. That to me is the rust, the opening the senses to the thrill, to the sambhogakaya that we have rejected because of whatever insanity of nationalism or this ism or that ism. You know, this world is incredibly, outrageously beautiful. Ramakrishna saw a cloud in the sky at 11 years old and he fainted. It was so beautiful. Like, that's rust. I used to sometimes have to hide the fact when I'd start crying when I see the faces of my little kids, because I just saw Russ. I just saw, you know, and they go, Daddy, what are you crying about? So that's why we need a container. But the world is Russ.
Beautiful. John Kay talks about the 18 rasas, and he starts this discourse about rasa saying, John Cage, the function of music is to quiet the mind, to make it sensitive to divine intervention. I read that, I listened that through John Cage, not to the Vedas, but I'm sure that came from the Vedas. So all the things about rasa is about co-creation. We realize that we are not alone. Rasa is like a veil, it's like a messenger that shifts the weight of the ego into the lightness of a cloud.
Rick, I really enjoyed this.
Oh, thank you for inviting me. It's a great, it's very Russ-filled moment?
I am full of goosebumps, and I am very honored that you wanted to do this experiment with us. This, yeah, for us is a journey. Thank you, John, for everything. Thank you for time. Thank you for duration. Thank you for Russ, and thank you for Tantra.
Okay, everybody. Much love. Jai Ma.
Thanks for joining us for episode 4 of Beyond Music. For more information on today's guest, Rick Jarrow, please visit www.rickjarrow.com. That's RICKJAROW. Footnotes on what was discussed today can be found in the podcast episode notes on your podcast platform, such as Apple or Spotify. To contact the Beyond Music team, please email beyondmusicpod@gmail.com. If you enjoyed this episode, please share on social media and give us a review. Thanks again for your support. This podcast is produced by Carmel Sound Lab. For more information, please visit www.carmelsoundlab.com.